The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your generally biweekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm IJ Senior Attorney Paul Sherman, joined by IJ Attorneys Kirby Thomas West and Managing Attorney of IJ's Florida office, Justin Pearson. Today we've got guns, peons, pork, and fossils. Justin, take it away with the First Circuit.
Sure. So the First Circuit case is about a challenge to a Massachusetts law that empowers cities to deny individuals the right to carry a gun in public unless they have a good reason to do so. And self-defense is not a good reason to do so under the statute unless the applicant has a particularized threat imposed against them that would make them at a higher risk than the generalized public.
Now, is this a statewide law or was this...
It's a statewide law, but the enforcement is delegated to the cities where the applicant has to apply to their local police chief to see if they meet this requirement for showing that they have a good reason to be able to exercise their Second Amendment rights.
Okay. And what qualifies as a good reason?
So one reason would be if they have a special threat that makes them need to have a gun for, in the eyes of the statute, a better reason than just the general public who wants to protect themselves. Another reason might be if they need the gun for their job or for their hobby. So if they're, you know, a sportsman or a security guard, they can have guns for those purposes, but only for the limited time when they're actually doing those things. The rest of the time when they're out and about, they have to leave their guns at home.
So this case is part of sort of a series of challenges that we've seen across the country, trying to flesh out the details of the Supreme Court's two decisions in District of Columbia versus Heller and McDonald versus City of Chicago.
That's right. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court hasn't provided any additional guidance after McDonald. And so the circuits are struggling with how to apply the cases.
So what happened here?
So what happened here is a challenge was brought by individuals who don't have any special reason why they're at a greater threat than the public, yet still want to carry guns in public for self-defense. And so they filed a Second Amendment challenge. And the circuit court really asked three questions. First, they ask whether the Second Amendment extends outside of the home in terms of its protection of your right to self-defense. Second, if it does, what level of scrutiny should apply? And then, of course, third, whether this law survives that level of scrutiny.
So Heller was really focused just on armed self-defense within the home, right?
Well, it was primarily focused on that in terms of the facts of Heller, but I think a fair reading of Heller would indicate that the Second Amendment protects your right to self-defense outside of the home as well. And to be fair, the circuit court panel found that also, but they said that even though the Second Amendment protects your right to self-defense outside of the home, that right is only analyzed through intermediate scrutiny instead of strict scrutiny, whereas if the regulation restricted your use inside the home, that would receive strict scrutiny.
Something that stood out to me when I read this opinion, and I'm sure to many people, is just the unworkability of the standard of how do you determine when someone has a special need for protection outside of the home. And obviously, you know, that changes throughout a person's life. It can change week to week. It changes when you move to one neighborhood or the other. And I think it was notable that the court specifically said the plaintiffs only brought a Second Amendment challenge here, and that was all they were considering. I think they left a really big opening for plaintiffs to bring a different kind of challenge about the application of this standard in practice and potentially affecting different populations differently and how this standard is applied.
Yeah, one of the things I found interesting about the opinion was that doctors and lawyers were more likely to get an unrestricted license than other groups of people. And, you know, certainly there are some kinds of doctors and some kinds of lawyers who may have legitimate concerns about angry clients or patients. But it's not clear to me that dermatologists or, you know, your standard trust in a state's attorney is at that much greater risk than the general public.
I would go further than that. I would say it might be likely that they would have less of a reason to be in fear of, you know, danger leaving their home than someone who lives in a high crime neighborhood. If you think about, you know, where doctors and lawyers tend to live, the violence there is typically far less than neighborhoods with, you know, less financially well-off people.
So the court says that the right to keep and bear arms extends outside the home. What did it do next?
Well, although it got off to that good start, as you mentioned, it relegated your right to self-defense outside of your home to second-class status. It said you won't get strict scrutiny in your challenge, only intermediate scrutiny. Although I think that that's the wrong approach, based on the lack of guidance from the Supreme Court, it's not completely unreasonable. But then things got even worse at the next step, where even though they claim to apply intermediate scrutiny, they don't actually apply intermediate scrutiny.
What do you mean by that?
So intermediate scrutiny is a type of test where the government still bears the burden. The burden isn't as heavy as under strict scrutiny, but the government still has to bear the burden of showing that the law materially furthers a substantial government interest and isn't unreasonably burdensome. What that basically means is that tie goes to the challenger. But here, the court ruled that tie goes to the government. What they did is they looked at the question of whether these types of laws substantially improve public safety. And what the court said was, well, there are studies going in all directions that all kind of canceled themselves out. And since they all canceled themselves out, what we're going to do is just defer to the legislature. In other words, tie goes to the government. But that's not intermediate scrutiny. So really what the panel was applying was some sort of hybrid between the rational basis test and intermediate scrutiny. I don't know what you should call it, but it's not intermediate scrutiny. Under intermediate scrutiny and the evidence described by the panel, the government should have lost.
Yeah, this is something interesting that, most of my practice focuses on the First Amendment and free speech. And there's a lot of different areas where the courts apply so-called intermediate scrutiny under the First Amendment. And one of the things that I find striking and that we've argued in briefs to the Supreme Court is that intermediate scrutiny is just so indeterminate. It really matters what judge you get. And also there's this multiplicity of intermediate scrutinies out there. So in commercial speech cases, courts tend to apply a robust form of intermediate scrutiny. In this case, they seem to have applied a more deferential form of intermediate scrutiny. In cases involving the regulation of the time, manner, and place of speech, they typically apply a more deferential version. And, this is something that Justice Scalia harped on in some of his opinions, that there's no real guidance to lower court judges.
I mean, I think that's true, and I don't think it's the way it should be, as you can probably tell. I mean, intermediate scrutiny is supposed to place the burden on the government. If they can't meet their burden, then the default, then the logical result of that should be that the challenger wins and gets to exercise their constitutionally protected rights.
Well, this is the subject of a circuit split, so I'm sure this isn't the last we're going to be hearing about this issue. Why don't we jump over now to the 11th Circuit and talk about peonage? Kirby, take it away.
So Montgomery, Alabama, like many cities across the country, has decided to raise revenues by looking to collect on outstanding fines and fees owed by its citizens, typically low-level violations like traffic violations. But the problem is not everybody can afford to pay the fines and fees that they owe the government. In those circumstances, the city says, hey, if you can't pay, you can pay it off by going to jail and working. So if you can't pay your fines and fees, you go to jail and you earn $50 a day credit towards the fines and fees that you owe. And in addition, while you're in jail, you're forced to participate in a work program where you earn an additional credit of $25 a day towards your outstanding debt to the city.
So in this case, the city alleges that the work program is optional, and the people who have filed this lawsuit say that in fact it is not optional, that they were coerced into participating. Is that right?
Right. It seems like there might be a factual dispute there about what was actually happening in the jails, because as you said, the city says it's not forced. The prisoners said, however, that they were told if they didn't do this work, they'd have more jail time added on. Because of this, they challenged the city under a federal anti-peonage statute, which prohibits forced labor. They also brought a challenge under the Alabama Constitution, which has a provision basically banning debtors' prisons, which they allege that this is. The district court, the defendants in the case were the mayor, chiefs of police, and the judges who run this these hearings and sentencings. And the defendants filed a motion to dismiss based on immunity. The district court denied that motion, and that's what brought it up to the 11th Circuit.
So people who are regular listeners of this podcast have heard a lot about qualified immunity, but for some folks who are new, why don't you explain what that is and also touch on absolute judicial immunity?
I'll do my best, but it's difficult because, as regular listeners also know, qualified immunity doesn't really come from anywhere other than judges' heads. So qualified immunity, it does not come from the text of Section 1983. It is a judge-made doctrine that says government officials get some special protections while they are executing their role as government officials. Qualified immunity means, as it says, it's qualified. It doesn't apply all the time. There are certain exceptions to the immunity. Unlike qualified immunity, however, judges get absolute judicial immunity, which means when they're exercising their role as judge, basically they can do whatever they want. There's nothing that they can do that you can challenge. The court here says, acts do not become less judicial by virtue of an allegation of malice or corruption of motive. So even if judges are acting with malice, absolute judicial immunity applies.
So what happens at the 11th Circuit?
So as you might be able to tell from how I've just phrased this, the 11th Circuit says the judges have absolute judicial immunity. There's nothing they can do. And the mayors and the chiefs of police get qualified immunity. Alabama's qualified immunity differs from state to state and how it's applied. Alabama's qualified immunity says that officials have immunity unless they act willfully, maliciously, fraudulently, in bad faith, beyond authority, or under mistaken interpretation of law, which from the text you would think, at least as alleged by plaintiffs in this case, that would apply here. The 11th Circuit says not so.
Why weren't the allegations enough?
So there's a lengthy discussion in here, too, about a failure to state a claim. And the 11th Circuit says that the only factual allegation, everything else was had no facts at all alleged, was that there were higher fine revenues in Montgomery than there were in Huntsville. And they said they can't really make much of this. It doesn't really speak to the claims of the plaintiffs. And so that's kind of wrapped up in their qualified immunity analysis, that there aren't a lot of facts here from which they can judge that, you know, these officials acted under mistaken interpretation of law, willfully, maliciously, et cetera, because there aren't a lot of factual allegations at all. Reading the first half of the opinion, I'm not sure that that's entirely true. It seems to be to me that I haven't read the complaint, but it seems to me that the plaintiffs made some kind of claim that this was really a concerted effort and that these certain judges had spoken about enacting this scheme to collect revenues and that other people involved have spoken about it. So, like I said, I haven't read the complaint, but it did seem to me from reading other parts of the opinion that there were some kind of facts alleged here, I think, sufficient to state a claim.
Yeah, and I think that's right. It's obviously a troubling opinion involving an extremely troubling set of allegations. The one glimmer of hope, I think, is that section talking about how so many of the allegations in the view of the court were conclusory. And so, perhaps, and maybe I'm just being overly optimistic here, but perhaps if they refile their challenge and provide more specific facts, they'll actually be able to pursue these claims. Again, that might be overly idealistic on my part. I think it is. I think you're right, but I hate to think that in that scenario there is just no ability to pursue a remedy. I mean, that's just outrageous.
It does seem outrageous, but
one of the things that concerned me reading this opinion is just sort of the question was, what would you allege if all of this was true, if you actually were the victim of a conspiracy by government officials to systematically deprive people of their rights and institute debtors' prisons? If saying that's not enough, it's not like you have access to the emails of the government officials. So you can't say like, oh, there's this smoking gun document that lets me file this lawsuit. So it's not clear how you could vindicate your rights in this
case.
Oh, and I was saying, especially when you're losing at the motion to dismiss stage, when you don't even get to pursue discovery, where you don't get to seek those emails that might provide the evidence you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe the solution here would be for judges to allow a certain limited amount of discovery to see if there's enough out there that can maybe create a triable issue of fact.
Right. And you're placing this really huge burden on indigent plaintiffs, the people who are affected by these kind of schemes and this kind of policy are people of such limited means and limited access to skilled attorneys. And this is an issue that, you know, the Supreme Court has spoken to about violations of due process and equal protection that are kind of at issue here. There's a case, Bearden v. Georgia from 1983, where the court says under either due process or equal protection, it's unconstitutional to revoke probation for failure to pay a fine if the failure to pay the fine was really because that person couldn't afford to pay a fine. So we have, you know, pretty strong case law out there saying you can't do this. And still we have a situation where people who are alleging this has been done to them have no recourse. They could have brought it up, when the sentences were imposed. But again, these are people of such limited means. You're placing a really huge burden on them to know what legal arguments to bring.
Well, I suppose the good news is, you know, going back to Paul's point about allowing some discoveries, you know, since this doctrine was created out of thin air, judges could change it as well.
And there have actually been increasing criticisms of qualified immunity in recent years, so maybe we'll see some action on that front. Why don't we jump over to a case that actually has a happy ending? We've got a First Amendment case out of the Fourth Circuit.
Right. So this case involved some nuisance lawsuits brought against hog farms. And the nature of the challenges were that there were multiple cases, all going to jury trials. And the federal judge realized that these cases were getting a lot of publicity. So he sua sponte, without anyone asking for it, he on his own, the judge, decided to issue a gag order, not allowing the attorneys, parties, or witnesses to talk about the case other than to say things that were already in the public record. So it's an extremely broad gag order. Some of the parties filed an appeal to the Fourth Circuit asking for writ of mandamus to instruct the judge to allow them to exercise their First Amendment rights. An unusual scenario ensued where the other party asked the judge to vacate his own order, and he agreed to do so while also scheduling additional briefing on the question of whether the gag order should be re-implemented, basically creating a parallel track of briefing going on while the appellate court was considering the appeal. And so it raises all sorts of interesting issues about mootness and jurisdiction. But at the end of the day, what the circuit court says is you can't have this briefing schedule going on at the same time as we have our appellate briefing schedule. And the petitioners don't have to wait around. They don't have to go through these other hoops. When you suffer First Amendment injury, that's irreparable harm. You don't have to ask the court for reconsideration. You can just go straight to the circuit court to decide whether there's actually a First Amendment violation.
And one of the interesting things about this case was that they actually did ask for clarification from the court, right?
That's right. Yeah, they reasonably contended that the order was vague. But as with every other aspect of this case, the district court did something kind of surprising. He disagreed that he should have to give them more clarity. It's really in some ways it's a disturbing opinion when you look at all the different things the district court did wrong. But the good news is the circuit court corrected those various injustices as well as reaching what I would contend was the right result in the First Amendment analysis as well.
So what did the circuit court do?
So the circuit court applied strict scrutiny and analyzed the rationale provided by the district court that this gag order was needed to protect jury pools so that they could, you know, be able to put together juries that were not tampered with by this public information. And in applying strict scrutiny, the Fourth Circuit found that the gag order actually failed multiple prongs of the test. As for the first prong, the court found that the gag order didn't actually further a compelling government interest because just by ordering the parties and attorneys not to speak about something doesn't mean it's still not going to be covered in the public. And as the court correctly points out, if you ban the people who know the most about the case from talking about it, the result could actually be public misinformation where the reporters are still reporting on the case but can't get accurate information. So that actually makes the problem worse instead of better.
Yep. One of the interesting statistics from the decision was that if corporations are forced to say no comment in response to questions from reporters, 62% of the public view that as them trying to cover up wrongdoing.
Right. And I think that's an important statistic. And it's just one part of a really terrific opinion by the panel. Overall, I would contend. I think this is a great example of an engaged panel really looking at the facts and the evidence and thinking about what's going on here and reaching the right result.
Two things I really liked about the opinion were, one, the discussion of how jurors are not as fragile as the district court seems to think they are. The court pointed to Rule 404B in the Federal Rules of Evidence, where you say, you know, there's certain evidence that's given to jurors about past criminal activity, and it can be relevant to motive and things like that, but you can't use this to have a view of the defendant as a person of bad moral character that's inclined to commit a certain crime. And so the court's saying, you know, we trust people, we trust jurors to look at information and make informed decisions and listen to the judge when the judge says, you can consider this for this reason, you can't consider this. And I think treating jurors and people like adults is a nice thing. And I also really, as Justin said, you know, I really appreciated the discussion of the value of the First Amendment and more information being better, I think is really nice to see judges talk about that. And especially as an institution, we have an interest in talking about litigation, and IJ has shown what great value there is in giving the public access to information about important litigation and development in the law.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And just going back to your point about a potential jurors not being fragile, you know, the court makes the point that an additional independent reason why the gag order fails strict scrutiny is because the district court didn't explain why voir dire wouldn't fix this problem. Someone can still serve on a jury even if they've heard of the issue, and so that's why we have voir dire. And if the district court really believed that this public discussion of the issue would somehow create some sort of irreparable harm that couldn't be fixed through voir dire, then the district court had the obligation of explaining this in the order, which the district court never did.
So we get an engaged opinion out of the Fourth Circuit.
That's right.
All right, well, let's jump over to the Ninth Circuit for our case about fossils.
Saving the best for last. This opinion gets a 10 out of 10 for readability from me. As an example, we start out, once upon a time in a place now known as Montana, dinosaurs roamed the land. Fast forward a couple millennia. In 2005, a family called the Seversons sold property to a family called the Murrays. When they made the sale of property, they reserved a 2/3 mineral estate. A year later, there was a massive discovery on the property of really interesting fossils. So there was a 22-foot long theropod, which is a group of dinosaurs that includes the Tyrannosaurus rex, and a 28-foot long ceratopsian, which includes the Triceratops. I did some background research for this, guys. And they were fossilized in the midst of a fight that has the nickname the Dueling Dinosaurs. And as you can imagine, this was incredibly valuable. It's appraised at $7 to $9 million. And other fossils were also found on the property, including a nearly intact T-Rex, which is one of about only 10, and a couple other things. And the other fossils besides the Dueling Dinosaurs have already been sold for several million dollars, and that money is being held until the resolution was being held until the resolution of this lawsuit. So the dispute here is, as mentioned, the Seversons did reserve 2/3 mineral rights in the estate, and the question is, do the fossils count as minerals? Under a technical scientific definition of the term mineral, fossils are made up of minerals and do qualify. But the district court said, under a normal reading of contractual language, people wouldn't understand minerals to include fossils. This doesn't count. This goes entirely to the Murrays. And the Seversons, unsurprisingly, given the amount of money at issue, appealed that decision here to the Ninth Circuit.
So the parties in this case referred to the two sets of rights as the mineral rights and the surface rights. And it seems like the dinosaur bones were actually discovered sticking out of the earth, like on the surface. So why doesn't that resolve the issue?
Right. It's interesting. The court doesn't really discuss that much, but I think you look at things of value that are taken out of the land and for use. That's kind of how the court talked about it, that, you know, you think about mining and this kind of seems to fit in with you're digging something out of the land for use for some other purpose, seems to go along with that.
Well, I mean, that's what the court said, but I think their logic is flawed. I mean, as they point out, the result of the court's analysis is that the definition of mineral turns on the economic value of what's at stake, which means, again, as the court points out, if you're talking about fossils that don't have much economic value, which is true of many fossils, they're not a mineral. But once they become valuable, they magically transform into a mineral. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Let's step back for a minute. This is a state contract dispute governed by state law. Why is the federal court even looking at this?
Right. So the court considered this case under its diversity jurisdiction. The Seversons are no longer residents of Montana. They are both residents of Florida. And when parties who live in one state are in litigation with parties in another state, you know, the federal courts have jurisdiction over that, kind of thinking you want a neutral arbiter. You don't want to have to go to either of the parties' kind of home court. You want somebody who is more, you want a more neutral playing field.
And they also met the amount in controversy requirement.
Oh, right, right.
So there's your little civil procedure lesson. To get into federal court in diversity jurisdiction, you have to have complete diversity of citizenship, and you have to have at least $75,000 at stake. That was easily met here because there were millions of dollars
right.
at stake. So what happens? Who wins?
So the court said that the district court got it wrong and that fossils are minerals, and they are technically minerals. And as Justin kind of alluded to already, that the reason they kind of come down on this is that there's a case out of, bizarrely, the Texas Supreme Court called Hynatz, evaluating what counts as a mineral. And there the definition turned on the rare and exceptional character. So something that you wouldn't think of as a mineral, though it technically is, can become a mineral for the legal sense of the word if it's of significantly rare and exceptional character. The Montana Supreme Court relied on that Texas Supreme Court decision twice, which the Ninth Circuit took as evidence that Montana had adopted that standard. Something that I think is interesting is the court also says, you know, typical kind of contractual interpretation, you know, where language is ambiguous, factual determination of the party's intent will resolve a dispute. There's not really a lot of that, though, here. You know, there's kind of more a more removed legal analysis of what does the word mineral mean, and very little discussion, in fact, of what the party's intent was upon entering the contract, which I thought was interesting.
There were things that could have been discussed. I mean, as the Short Circuit newsletter pointed out, that, you know, it links to a Smithsonian article talking about the backstory of how this case arose. And the Murrays, you know, the surface rights owner, the property owner, clearly thought that he would reap the rewards of these types of findings, because long before this happened, he took the time and actually hired someone to help him go around looking for these fossils on his property, which he would not have done if he thought that they were not actually his. But for whatever reason, the court doesn't spend much time on that.
I'm skeptical of that. I mean, a third of several million dollars is still kind of worth going after, in my opinion. I would still make an effort to find it.
Fair point.
For my property.
You know, one of the interesting things is we talk about what the intent of the parties was, and in a lot of these cases, it's likely that the parties had no specific intent regarding these sorts of things. You know, if the subject of fossils had come up, maybe they would have discussed it, but there's a very good chance they were thinking about things other than fossils. And so the court has to kind of thread that needle. You know, another principle of contract law, which wasn't discussed in this case, but that I was sort of expecting as I was reading the opinion, was that typically ambiguity in contracts is construed against the person who drafted the contract. I don't know which party drafted the contract in this case, but that seems like it would have been another way for the court to resolve this.
Yeah, I agree. I hadn't thought about that. I think that's actually a better way to resolve it, quite
well,
frankly.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I agree.
All right. Well, that wraps up all our cases. Before we conclude, however, I want to introduce a new feature on Short Circuit that I've just made up in honor of the author of the First Circuit opinion we discussed, Senior Judge Bruce Selya. For those who don't know, Judge Selya is well known for peppering his opinions with unique vocabulary, words that you probably haven't heard of. And this week's word of the week is sockdolager. Sockdolager is a noun that means something that settles a matter, a decisive blow or argument. Well, that's going to do it for us. Thank you so much for joining us on Short Circuit. We'll see you next time. Until then, this is Paul Sherman urging you to get engaged.